Good afternoon and welcome to the Elephant in the Room here on WJAS 1320 AM and 99.1 FM Talk. This is your host, Sam DeMarco, and joined in studio today, he's back. The man, the myth, the legend, the best executive director in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, John Schneider.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey,
it's good to be back. Yeah. Good to be back. I've missed you and Daryl. So thank you.
Daryl, I think he just said more words there than he has the entire last quarter.
I think so. You're both back. I miss both you guys.
Oh, yeah. Big week last week.
Right.
We have our producer, Dazzling Dandy, Daryl Grandy. Daryl, thank you for being here. The man that makes the magic happen, gets everything out to our folks.
And a shout to Erin Cooper for filling in for you last week.
Absolutely. Erin did a great job. She's a guest host here. She fills in as well as a number of folks do. And we really do appreciate and want to thank her for that. They had a great show last week. Now, we're excited today. We're joined in studio by our friend, Republican strategist, and the principal behind Bridge Connections, Keith Schmidt. Keith, welcome to the show.
Sam, great to be here as always, especially after the outcome of the recent election. I would, it's exciting to be back to kind of recap a lot of the predictions that we sought to predict, and we were pretty close to the mark this time. I mean, it's not always the case. In 44 years in government and politics, I've lost as many races as I've won, but this one felt particularly good because the country's at a crossroads and we really needed it to happen. And I think collectively, Democrats, Republicans and like-minded Democrats and independents came together and the people were heard, Sam. I mean, and it's unlike other transitions, and I know we're just starting the show, but I've been through 11 transitions since I've got active in politics starting back in 1980, and this one is very unique, and I'd love to chat to your listeners about this in the coming hour.
Well, we'll certainly cover that, because you're right. This is something that's been unique, nothing else like it in history, where the president-elect is essentially functioning as the president prior to actually his inauguration or being sworn in.
Right, exactly.
And that is what is incredibly unique about this.
And we all feel it, no matter what your opinion of is. The reality is that's what's happening. You could even be uncomfortable with that situation, but you acknowledge it.
Yep. And I will tell you, I mean, again, let's take a step back. I was out last week, was up in New York for PA Society. And it's a typical annual gathering where all the top political figures and business people get together and, from Pennsylvania for the weekend. They attend receptions, galas, the annual dinner and things of that nature.
20 plus years.
And it had it was a different feel this year. I mean, a real buzz. And, you talked about, us being back, okay? And, Dave McCormick, when he was out on the campaign trail, he would talk about two things. One, he knew, and he called this as a change election. When 70% of the people, and you heard me say this on the show, many of the folks have heard me say this on the show previously, that 70% of the people out there felt this country was headed in the wrong direction, And Dave would always take and remark that, America has been here before, walked right up to the edge of the abyss and then stepped back. And I really feel that is an appropriate statement for where we were as a country, and where we were headed. I mean, obviously, Joe Biden, President Biden was, suffering some ills here and was not the man, that he once was, and certainly was not the guy in charge. And Kamala Harris, was out to lunch as well. So, who knows who was running the country, but when you look at what was happening, the open southern border, the chaos around the world, wars in the Middle East and in Ukraine, inflation and prices rising here at home, energy costs, increasing, crime rampant throughout some of our major cities. I mean, we were facing some dire circumstances. And now all of a sudden, Reagan in 1984 ran on Morning in America. But now it almost seems like a new dawn.
Sure.
Is rising. You have that hope is back in a better future.
I mean, it's not the first time. Obviously, we know, and history will tell us, that President Cleveland had non-consecutive terms, but the world was a different place then. America was a different place. We didn't have the technology and the media and the involvement on a daily basis of what's happening in the world of politics and government here at home and abroad. We're much more hands-on. We're much more knowledgeable and in touch. And so there's two things that are leading to this odd transition. One, obviously, is he was president. So although he's going to be president again, it's easy to see him in that role. And he almost, you know, by default is the president now. I mean, he it's not like he's the elect because he once held that office. So the world leaders and other people of consequence around the globe treat him as a sitting head of state. And I could see where that would happen because he was there for 4 years and now has been asked back. The other part of it is what you mentioned. The Democrats at the, you know, maybe too late in his term, but finally reckoned with the fact that the sitting president was not in a position to cognitively, physically, mentally, to withstand another 4 years. So there was a sense that because of him stepping aside, because he could not handle potentially the rigors of the office, it's easier to let go of him. You know, it's like, okay, you already decided. And once he made that decision, you know, the rest of his administration kind of went on a downward spiral. It's mm-hmm. different at Kamala One. She did not. But now they've basically turned the page. Not in an insulting way. I mean, he's still the president and there's still functional things that he has to do. But we are so anxious to turn the page and to start a new administration that in many ways that administration started the day after election.
No, absolutely. And I think when we talk about this, one of the other things that has changed dramatically different than 2016. You know, when President Trump was first elected back in 2016, the resistance was out in full force. You know, all the false claims of Russian interference and, you know, all those different things. You had the resistance forming and folks in the streets. And things are much more mellow and calm this time, almost as if the country at large isn't as divided, is coming together in some ways, hoping and looking towards a brighter future.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, so yeah. And we see that now. So you see it with his cabinet picks as well, Keith. You know, when you look at that, even though despite having made some picks that some folks viewed as controversial, such as Pete Hegseth to lead the Department of Defense or Tulsi Gabbard, and now you're seeing folks rallying around them. And I believe that both of them will be confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
Well, there's a part of America that felt cheated because he wasn't returned to office. He lost re-election. And they liked the way things were going, and they already feel in some ways, Sam, that they're 4 years behind. Like, we need to catch up.
Right.
We could have already been here right now, so they're anxious. And we understand generally because of technology and the phones we're all on 24 hours a day, we have no patience. You know, we are so anxious to close this border. We're so anxious to reset our standing in the world. We're so anxious to end these conflicts and to bring America back together economically, socially, politically. It's been a rough time. It's been a long time of deep divisions. And there's almost good. There's a part of me that thinks this is good that this is a second term. There's a part of the Trump and the anti-Trump movement, the Trump haters, that will be dissipated because they were hated him because they wanted to stop his political success. They didn't want him to be elected or reelected. Well, that's off the table now.
Right.
Now he's our president, and you have nothing to lose to have a successful turnaround of this economy, to start addressing the serious issue of crime and homelessness in America, get people back to work. They're literally excited. I know even the smallest business, because you really think – small businesses aren't going to be affected by the mega businesses. But I've heard from multiple owners of restaurants, boy, just the sense that they're talking about putting federal workers back to work again, setting the tone. He said it's so hard at every level of business to get people to want to come to work or think that that's part of the equation in America. I can make just as much. I don't need to show up for work. He said, and it's created such a negative atmosphere in the service mm-hmm. industry that, listen, I just remind people, restaurants aren't closed an extra day or stopping dinner at 8 or 9 because they don't have business. They're closing an extra day and shortening hours because they don't have workers.
Right.
You know, they have business. They don't have workers. So they said, we just need someone to lead. And I know, I can imagine it's the mayor of Washington is I'm sure, relieved because now almost for 4 years she's been saying since COVID, you're killing me. You need to send federal workers back to work. We don't have a tax base without these people coming, parking, buying a cup of coffee, buying lunch, buying retail items during their 8 hours in the District of Columbia. And they were suffering. And the finances, when you look at the bottom line, and you're a councilman, so you know that you have to look at budgets. They're on death's door financially because of what do they say, 6% of federal employees are going to work 5 days
exactly.
a week now?
Only,
is that
exactly.
what it is? Is it that low?
Yes.
I think that's what I heard, 6%.
That's what you heard, only 6%. I thought
it was going to be – I thought it would be low when they told me it was like 30%. And then right. I said, no, the number is 6. That's ridiculous. Show leadership from the top. It's time to get back to work.
Well, I'm excited about, like you said, I'm excited about what Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are going to do here with the Department of Government Efficiency. They're taking a cue, I think, from Javier Milei, who's the president of Argentina, who came in and totally dismantled much of the bureaucratic regime in Argentina. And now, for the first time in like 150 years, their balanced budget, right? They're no longer, in debt. This is no longer running a deficit. I mean, this is incredibly exciting time as we look at what does the future hold. Now one of the things, and I found this out firsthand here in Allegheny County, Keith, and you know this from your time serving, under Senator Santorum, that for every dollar that the federal government dispenses, there's a hand at the other end of that dollar to receive it. And these people hold on to that with a death grip and will fight like cats and dogs to keep those dollars coming. So it's going to be interesting to see the type of resistance, how the scale and scope of it that these folks face as they look to make some of these changes to rein in the federal government and the administrative state.
I feel like I've shielded you. I've given you the subjects to talk about, because if I had my own druthers on, I could choose it, I would have started with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, right? Yeah. Because I've been talking about that a lot to anyone who will listen. Yeah, I am really, believe it or not, for the first time, as I said, I go all the way back to 80, a long time, but I'm finally excited about this new commission, because make no mistake, every president, including Ronald Reagan and the Bush and all the ones that were on our side, they all talk the talk on making government efficient. Mm-hmm. The only difference is, and we all got somewhat disappointed, they tried their best, it didn't work out. Let me tell you what's different about this time. If I told you the team that Reagan put in place failed, the team that Clinton put in place failed, Carter's team failed, this place, I could say they failed, but I can't say who failed. I couldn't name one of them. I wouldn't know, but Musk and Ramaswamy are brands unto themselves. And I could tell you now, when I have my contacts that I have and some junior staff members that I know are involved in the transition and Don Mar-a-Lago, they've apparently visited more than any other cabinet secretary. Their appointment, and I'm sure they're going down there saying, Mr. President, you got to have teeth on this. We don't need this job. We have our own brand. Exactly. We have our own reputation. We're not going to do this to 2 years and fail, because you've then, not only do we don't care about the money, you've hurt our brand. Right. I mean, we are successful in our own right. We'll do it, but you got to give me the teeth to do it. You cannot allow us to fail. You have to stand with us and make these tough decisions and make the calls to Congress and really have something substantial to report in 2 years. So I am bullish on the fact, because these are such profile individuals and like I said, I use the word brand. They have their own brand that they're not going to fail. I'm just telling you, they're not going to fail. And for the first time in my many years in this vineyard of politics, I think we're actually going to have real reform. And that's exciting. It will be exciting to people. I mean, because we all want it, but it's like a joke. We all talk about it. Nobody does it, Sam. But I have an inkling that this time it's going to be different.
Well, one of the things that I see that's different this time, and I really like what I'm seeing. You know, we started off the show talking a little bit about how President-elect Trump, is the de facto leader of the free world now, and being so recognized by so many of the world leaders that are out there. But they are lining up things. They're working incredibly hard. He's not out there in the media, not out there. They're working incredibly hard, and they're going to have to act fast. You know, in the military, when we invaded Iraq, back in 19, excuse me, we didn't invade Iraq. but we fought the first Gulf War. That was in 1991, I believe. Mm-hmm. But they talked about shock and awe.
Right.
That was the military strategy, to hit them hard and hit them so fast and so big that they didn't know what was coming. That's what I think we're going to see after Donald Trump is sworn into office. Because you know, traditionally, you have about 18 months in order to accomplish a number of things before you're 6 months before the midterms. Everyone starts to worry about reelection, you know, and all that stuff takes place. So he's going to have to get moving right out of the gate. And I think the longer you delay and the longer you talk about something, the more time you give the opposition to be able to organize and build up a resistance to it, the sure. whole bit. Whereas if you just come out and boom, here's the executive order. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what department we're going to slash or cut. Here's how we're going to do this. Here's who we're going to move out of D.C., you know, and send back to some other state.
Right. I mean, the conflicts have changed. The scope of the conflicts have changed in both the Middle East and in quite frankly, the threat of the conflict in Asia with China, Ukraine, all these the whole European Union taking stances that they've never taken before. Mexico and Canada reacting to the provocative language that he's put out there on trade. And they're already taking steps to the negotiation, and they're doing what they can in anticipation for what they know is going to happen. Why do they know it's going to happen? Because he's been president before.
Exactly.
They know exactly who they're dealing with.
Yep.
They just have to go back to that page. It's existed not in a distant future, but just 4 years ago. They know how he negotiates. They know he's a man of his word. So they're going to take certain actions in advance to show the confidence that, you know, they want to be at the table. They want a fair deal, and out of respect, they're starting to do it.
Yeah.
The only example in our lifetime that you could see that there was a reaction that we all knew about was when the first inauguration for Ronald Reagan. I mean, when he raised his right hand and that morning the hostages went free.
Yes.
Because they knew that the order before he went to the podium was already there. You know, we're going to take action the moment I'm sworn in. When I'm the president, this is what we're going to do to free these hostages. And they basically knew Reagan was a man of his word. He made it very clear. And hours before the ceremony, the American hostages held for 444 days came home because they were anticipating what would happen under Reagan.
I thought it was happening at the same time. I thought I remember him being sworn in and then the news talking about or covering the liftoff of the jet
line. Oh, yeah. It was the time. It was that morning. It was late morning. Yep. He was sworn in at noon.
Yep.
I mean, literally, in fact, I think for the time, I'm wondering because Carter left early or came late because he wanted to welcome them home. And the president, the new president said, yes, you were the person that you should go there and welcome them home. It shouldn't be me. You know, this was your deal.
Well,
and you did it. And he gave him credit, you know, that it happened. But they knew. But the interesting thing here is there's a might there, right? I mean, we all felt we finally pushed out our chests in 1981 after Watergate and Vietnam and the gas shortages and the malaise and the Iranian experience. We had a tough decade,
right?
A real tough day, and that was the first time that we looked like the strong American institution that we were, where they actually feared. They had a healthy fear of Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
You know,
he was a cowboy.
They
were worried about him. Now, interesting parallel, because Donald Trump has said if the American hostages are not released,
yes,
you know, by the time he's inaugurated, that there's going to be hell to pay out there.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So what is Hamas going to do, Islamic Jihad, or any of these other groups or countries that are holding Americans hostage right now? You know, do they want to bear the consequences,
right,
of failing to deliver these Americans that they're currently preventing?
Yeah, they have a window here to get it done, and they'd be wise to take advantage of this window.
No, absolutely. So no, it's an exciting time, and you know, looking forward to it. But again, I'm just so impressed. The first time he was president, I mean, no one expected him to win. He may not have expected to have won, and he came in there and really didn't know. You don't know where the light switches are, right? You're trying to learn your way around.
Sure.
You don't understand many of the traps that are set for you in these different agencies and bureaucracies, you know, whether it be the intelligence community. I mean, I remember some of the very first calls he was making to foreign leaders. You had people sharing, you know, the confidential contents of those calls.
Well, in a microcosm, I mean, Biden, like his former boss, created the opportunity. Both of these gentlemen created the opportunity for President Trump's victories.
Yes.
And, you know, after 8 years of Biden, we were tired with apologizing to the world. We were tired of political correctness. It was a time to be, you know, to make America strong again and great again. And to a degree, for these 4 years, we went back to our old ways again. We went back to the being apologists and that and leading with political correctness when people are you know, on the streets, people are being murdered, millions of people are crossing the border. They were worried about things that, like, what are you worried about? Is that really your number one issue? When we have tens of millions of people crossing the border, when the cities are war zones, when people don't feel safe in their homes, when the world's on fire, and you're going to lead with political correctness and telling us how bad we are to the world and we don't do enough? People have had it. They had it for 8 years. And to a degree, the reason he's coming back is the same reason he came to us in 16. They had enough of it. They wanted to refocus and laser focus the government on the things that we should be involved in. And Trump made it crystal clear that's going to be, you know, the length and breadth of his work. He's going to concentrate on turning things around with him quick. And he knows he's time-stamped. This is not a first term. He's 78 or years old. Like, I got to get it done. As much as impatient as we are, the good news is the president-elect is more impatient.
Right.
And that's why it's a disruptive cabinet. He doesn't want anyone to sit on the laurels. He wants actions, and he wants actions in the first 100 days. He wants people to see and palpably feel changes are coming in America, and they're going to come quickly.
But one of the interesting things you brought up a little earlier, you were talking about how Canada and Mexico reacted to his statements in regards to tariffs.
Right.
And immediately, you know, Mexico is going to take and secure the border. You know, Canada is going to do the same thing. But the one folks or the one segment of society here who hasn't learned their lesson is the press, because the press is still out there. I mean, President Trump was interviewed by Kristen Welker from NBC the other day. And he answered her question, but she was so fixated. Are you going to take and go after your enemy? Are you going to take and how are you going to deport people? And they're talking about the cost of all these things. And it'll cost $150 billion to deport folks. How about we just start with the people that are killing Americans?
Right.
And absolutely. Why don't we just start with the folks that are committing crimes?
Right.
Okay. And you work down from there. Right. But all these folks, they just jump and leap. And anything he utters, they take it to the furthest extreme. And, you know, again, trying to cause consternation and controversy out there. And, so they haven't, even as they lose their legitimacy and their position as the folks that people turn to, you know, for their news, they refuse to just give us the news without the opinion and let us make up our own minds and make decisions.
Listen, make no mistake, Sam. We're not going to – it's almost an impossibility for us to be able to successfully deport over 10 million people. But the important thing is to have a policy of deportation. That's what you need. That stops the money.
Yes.
You don't get Social Security. You don't get health care. Let me tell you, they're going to self-deport.
Oh, when they, exactly.
A number
when
of people, when the money is
off.
Gone
yep.
and the
yep.
benefits are gone, they're gone.
Yep.
I mean, in the end, of course, it's common sense. All of us believe that you have to, what is it, 400 and some thousand that are absolutely have
like
committed crime.
Was it like 423,000 or something like that?
It was
like
over
that.
400,000.
Yeah.
That's absolutely the number one target. But soon as there is a national deportation policy, the funds dry up. You know, all of a sudden you're not getting checks from the government. It's not coming out of our Social Security. It's not coming out of our health
care. You're not staying in a 5-star luxury hotel.
And when
yes.
you show up for you broke your hand, you go to an emergency room, and we find you're illegal. You're going to be deported.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have access to. You're now living in a state where it's no longer really safe here, and you don't have resources. So to a degree, you may make a decision I'm going to go home. I can find, it's not as good, you know, there's no longer the proverbial gravy train now that I can live off of. So yes, is it going to be hard? Or are we going to mass deport? We're going to have a policy of deportation. And to the degree that we can identify these people and send them home that cross the borders illegally, we will. But this whole fear factor that they're playing is nonsense. It's nonsense.
Well, they're listen, this is right out of the leftist Marxist playbook, okay? And we saw a little bit about that here in Allegheny County. We'll talk about it in the next segment in regards to the budget debate, okay, where they took and claimed that if they didn't get a $2.2 million increase, an increase of $170-plus million in new taxes, that all of a sudden the sky was going to fall. And none of that was true, okay? But, hey, we'll talk more about this right after the break. This is Sam DeMarco, your host of The Alpha in the Room on WJAS, 1320 AM, 99.1 FM Talk. We're here with Keith Schmidt, Republican strategist and principal and founder of Bridge Connections. And we'll be right back after the break. Welcome back, folks, to The Alpha in the Room. We were just speaking in the last segment here with Keith Schmidt, Republican strategist and founder of Bridge Connections. Keith, we were talking about President Trump, the transition, and you know, I want to take a few minutes talking about our new senator-elect Dave McCormick, who took down the fabled Bob Casey, the vaunted senator that three terms in the Pennsylvania Senate in the United States Senate from Pennsylvania, and nobody thought it was possible, and Dave went out and got it done.
Yeah, it's a sigh of relief for Republicans. There was a lot of concern over the state purple, and in some ways in recent years feeling almost blue at times. I mean, we knew we can get our act together. We knew the issues favored us. We weren't putting the right message across, or the messenger, whatever it was, we needed to find our way. And it's been a long time, but I really feel like we found our way this year. I mean, I think we righted that ship to a degree. I mean, you have to remember the history of Pennsylvania in senatorial politics. We only started electing senators for most of our time in our nation's history. State legislatures picked your senators, but in the constitutional amendment, I think of 1913, they changed the rules, and then they were elected by the population of the state. And since that time, because I served with Senator Santorum a generation ago, and from the time they started electing senators to the time of Specter Santorum, there was only one Democratic senator in the 1960s for 6 years. Other than that, the entire history in Pennsylvania was all Republican senators. They never elected a Democrat. So I mean, the pendulum certainly in the last 18 years have swung to the point where, lo and behold, we were in a position where we had no United States senator. Right. So it is certainly welcome to see a active player in Senator-elect McCormick, somebody who's going to hit the ground running and want to be consequential. And we say that because, I don't want to besmirch in any way, shape, or form, because I believe that the outgoing senator is an honorable man and served his state well, but he was not an activist by any means. You can't say he didn't show up to vote. That he represented a certain constituency, but he wasn't someone who got his feet wet in policy or sponsored bills or advocated for things. He was never rarely in the paper, making news like the U. Scotts and the John Hines and Specter and Santorum. But to a degree, you can say what you want. I mean, he literally almost in a wave election. We have to hit the ground running with the new senator because we have work to do still. Because in this wave election, I reminded people that he was elected and reelected in 6, 12, and 18, three hugely huge pluralities for Democrats nationally. Yep. It was a wave.
Yes.
And now there was obviously no wave here. If there was any wave, it was our wave.
Right.
And literally he lost by around a vote a precinct. I mean, so it does tell you, unfortunately, in politics, for as engrossed as you and I are and active we are, so many people aren't. And if you don't take a position on anything and you stay neutral and you stay out of the paper, you also don't get people mad at you either. I mean, when you take no stands, you can literally just kind of make your way through. And interestingly enough, I'm so glad the outcome we got happened. But it was that close. I mean, it was that close. So what I encourage our new senator to do is to understand that we have to show a different version of what a United States senator should be for the fifth largest state in the union. And for all intents and purposes, and you're closer to it than me, he has every reason to believe that this is going to be a very active, very visible, very hands-on United States senator, and I think he's going to put us back on the map. Don't you agree?
Well, I think he's more than putting us back on the map. I think he's going to put us at the front of the line.
Well, that's good.
I mean, you know, I mean, this guy, you know, a couple things. One, you talked about Casey, and if you don't come out and take a stand a little bit, but one of the things that the McCormick folks have told me from the beginning and why they felt confident in their race was that there were so many people out there that couldn't name a single thing that Bob Casey had done. There were so many people out there that really, it's unbelievable to folks like you and I who didn't know him, the name, right?
Yeah, I couldn't name him who it was.
You know, and so, you know, McCormick was close, you know, despite having minimal name recognition. You know, and that's why they worked to build up, you know, the positive ads for him. And, you know, I want to give a shout out to Montana Senator Steve Daines, because he was the one responsible for the Senate's Republican campaign committee this term. He went out and recruited candidates across the land, and they were great candidates. There were a lot of good candidates that didn't get across the finish line here.
Sure.
But what that did is it forced the Democrats to play defense. You know, and Chuck Schumer had X amount of money. He had to spread it. So that allowed the McCormick folks to basically have the spring to themselves to take and define Dave, you know, as the man he is, you know, veteran, businessman, leader, you know, father. And then the Casey folks dumped like $50 million into the summer, you know, with negative ads. And when the McCormick folks came back after Labor Day with all the money they needed to get through Election Day, I mean, it was just a matter of the gap closing. And you know, traditionally, in the past, they say people don't start paying attention to elections until after Labor Day. And traditionally, Republicans close the gap in September and October. That's what happened here, you know, and Dave prevailed. And I can tell you, he is out there now. I mean, just like President Trump, Senator-elect McCormick is out there now meeting with key stakeholders here within the state. You know, while he's looking to build his team, he's also meeting with these folks, and the reports we're getting, both from Democrat and Republican, are how excited they are because they can feel his energy. They can see that he's somebody that's looking to get things done on behalf of the people he represents.
Well, it's been so long that people forget the power that the institution of the United States Senate and how powerful it is and how influential it is and what a bully pulpit it is. You know, it rolled off my tongue, the Hugh Scotts and the John Hines and the Rick Santorums and Arlen Specters at the time of the height of their time, they were giants. And why were they giants? Because people in California knew their name. People in Florida knew their name. Love them or hate them, they were national figures. They met at the White House with the president. There was a sense of they looked beyond the border saying, I have a constituency, but I represent the United States of America. I decide whether we go to war. I decide on international affairs. And they were players beyond the Commonwealth. And I can tell you it's been a generation since we had somebody in office from Pennsylvania, the fifth largest state of the Union. America's started here in Philadelphia. That people in other parts of the country knew. And I'm pretty confident that within a year, they're going to know Senator McCormick's name. He's going to be that player that's going to give us now back to having some national prominence and national influence. And I would suggest it doesn't happen overnight, but I'd say give him a year. And I think Dave McCormick will turn some heads and realize that he's a player on not only the Pennsylvania stage, but the national and international stage. He has a lot to offer.
No, absolutely. I mean, the guy wrote a great book, you know, talking about superpower in peril here earlier last year. And I'm very excited.
Sure.
About where he's going to go and looking forward to great things from our new senator. Now, we got elections coming up next year, Keith. This is one of the I don't want to say bad things, but one of the duties of a chairman of a county party is that you never get a break. Okay? I mean, I had to push back and tell people, you know, who wanted to meet with me and talk to me, please, after the election, okay? Because they all want to talk about their candidacy for their future, what they want to do, the whole bit. So we have some big races coming up next year. I mean, we just saw in the city of Pittsburgh, the mayor's race. We saw it right now. You have the incumbent, Ed Gainey, who by all accounts, most folks believe has not done a good job, you know, managing the city. And then you have the county controller, Corey O'Connor, you know, the son of a former mayor, yep. Bob O'Connor,
your friend of
who's
mine.
Thrown his hat into the ring. How do you see that race shaping up?
Well, I think this is an enormously critical crossroads for the city of Pittsburgh. I mean, it's one of those things where when you leave Pittsburgh, we all know when you go to Los Angeles or Chicago or Miami or Detroit and you talk about Pittsburgh, although it's only 300,000, now I think it's under 300,000. There's less than 300,000 people that are now occupied, even though the metro area is 2.5 million. It's only 300,000, but they want to know who the mayor of Pittsburgh, or they know who the mayor of Pittsburgh is. It's almost a local office to a degree. They, right. People are shocked when I say there's less than 300,000 people in the city of Pittsburgh. Like, what? Yes. Well, because they think of the metro area. So if but it is without a doubt that 300,000, and I don't live in a city and you don't, but I recognize that it is the heart of the region. And if it fails, no we doubt. Die. And everyone says, I don't care about the city. If you care about where you live in the metro area, you have to care about the city, because if it dies, we die with it. We are closer than you know, as hard as we're working in the suburbs and in the metro area. If we allow the city to die on the vine, you know, we're going to be a Detroit in quick order. And we can't act independently of them. I don't care what happens. I beg people, pay attention, invest in candidates, even if you can't vote for them, if you care about this region. And we have major employers up to and including UPMC, who I know have generous offers. Not that they'd ever leave the hospitals, but you have to understand, you know it, their corporate offices are in the city of Pittsburgh.
Yes.
And they have generous offers on the table from Butler County, from Washington County, from Beaver County, from Westmoreland County, that would lay out the red carpet. And I could tell you that their tolerance of this current administration, if somehow he'd find a way to re-election, which I think is a tall order for as bad as the situation is economically, crime, homelessness, I mean, whatever agenda that he promised a little under 4 years ago, none of it has been realized. And it is a talking point that Pittsburgh is dying on the vine, and they're looking for a panacea. And I can tell you, I've known the O'Connors for years. I was close friends with his late father, Mayor Bob O'Connor, and Corey O'Connor is as hardworking and honorable a public servant as I've met in my lifetime. And I always say he knows what he doesn't know. He's not an arrogant guy that says, I know everything. He surrounds himself with good people, an A-team, and he knows how to discern good and bad advice because his dad and his family have made him street smart. And he's not worried about putting experts in the room like they'll intimidate him. He understands we need an A-team. And one of the problems is, Sam, I don't think that team is in place right now. They're good, honorable people, I'm sure. But we did not attract the best and brightest to government to try to solve the problems that we were strapped with 4 years ago. And as a result, we're spinning our wheels. So I think this is a critical election. And listen, I'd like to say that Republicans, because of his woes, have a chance, but the numbers are the numbers. We're building. But the city of Pittsburgh, you have to understand, if it was the mayor of Allegheny County, we'd have a candidate, and by God, I think we could probably win it, the mayor of Allegheny yep. County. But it's the mayor of Pittsburgh, so we have to sometimes call balls and strikes. And I think the Republicans would be best served if they saw the pendulum swing to Corey O'Connor in May, right, this year. It goes back
I
to May.
I believe so. And folks who are listening in and wonder what does Keith mean by this, it's important to understand that in the Allegheny County area here, Allegheny County, we have approximately about 950,000 registered voters. It's almost a 2-to-1. It's just under a 2-to-1 Democrat to Republican registered voter advantage. But in the city, the registered voter advantage Democrat to Republican is like 5.5-to-1.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So despite the great work being done
sure.
by our Pittsburgh City Committee, you know, under the leadership of Todd and Russell, these folks, they're doing the best that they can, and they are making progress, you know, but it takes time. There hasn't been a Republican mayor of the city of Pittsburgh since 1933. So all the folks who complain about problems in the city, they need to look to the Democrats, you know, for having brought them upon them, because we haven't had the opportunity to do that. There's not a Republican on city council.
Right.
And that needs to change.
Right. That's,
you know, absolutely. I would like to offer a referendum or put a petition out to get referendum signatures this year to try to create two at-large positions on city council, you know, so that at least, you know, Republicans, the folks that do live in the city, can at least feel that they're being represented.
Sure.
You know, so yeah, it's going to be interesting. We've had a number of folks reach out potentially about running for mayor in the city of Pittsburgh, but it is going to be an uphill battle. But I think it's important that you have someone in there to be able to engage in the debate, to be able to, you know, stand for our principles and values. But it is going to be very interesting here. Now, one of the other parts about this, Keith, is you have to look to county council to see what they do, because back in 2023, before he left, Tom Dewar got a number of campaign finance bills passed. Now, what he told members of council, and I voted against this, but he told members of council, well, he was working on cleaning up the money and fixing this the whole bit, but he ended up restricting what a person or somebody like a union could give to a particular person to the federal limit, which is $3,900 a cycle.
Right.
Okay. But he didn't do anything to stop the dark money, where SEIU puts $1 million in, you know, where George Soros comes and puts $2 million in. So what you've done is you've basically created an incumbent protection program.
Sure.
Okay. And you're preventing anybody from being able to run. So I talked to some members of county council about putting that up, getting legislation out there as soon as possible, the beginning of January, to repeal, you know, those bills so that we could have a free and fair election.
Yeah, it does give an enormous advantage to incumbents. And now you have the situation where you have the PAC money, the third, the independent expenditures,
right,
redefine the race. All of a sudden now, you run for an office and the one that you mandate and put restrictions on accounts for maybe 25% of the spend. And then 75% has no reporting. You have independent expenditures. You have no control over it. But literally that's what's running the race now, because it's just like having a clogged valve. They'll find ways around it. It's better to allow the legitimate fund that you oversee, allow more money to flow into that. You know, because otherwise it'll find a way. Money finds a way. And now they've already made everybody running for major offices form a separate independent PAC and allow it to be run by outside people. And like I said, by comparison, it's now, in most cases, now doubling the amount spent on your official account, which is ridiculous. No, not the same reporting, not the same transparency. The system is broken. I mean, I think he may have had good intentions with where that was heading, but it didn't work. And it's best when you fail to recognize failure quickly and right-size it. You know, don't say, oh, we made a mistake, and then you live with it for a generation. That's foolish. I'm glad that you're telling me you're gonna make some noise to say it's time to roll this back and give them solid examples of it hasn't worked. Right. You know, it's actually empowered, and it's become a protection of incumbents plan. You know, and it hasn't served the average voter, average citizen of Allegheny County well.
Yeah, no, it's it is certainly something that, you know, he I understand his intention, but this created an uneven playing field and significantly and severely restricts the ability of the people of Pittsburgh to be able to elect a mayor, you know, that they'd believe,
sure,
would represent.
And I am excited about the fact that you threw out there about, you know, the possibility of some sort of referendum relooking at city council. And I think two at-large members and allowing the minority party to have representation is brilliant. But I have long been a critic of what Pittsburgh did not that many years ago. And we're the only city, we should have an asterisk. We're the only city in America that took the opposite approach to city government, because when we had 700,000 people in 1960 in the city of Pittsburgh, all nine members ran at large, and they were all giants. You ran for mayor, you ran for the Sophie Maslow, the Jeep T. Busquals. They were everybody knew them. I mean, they were almost local celebrities because they had the same constituency as the mayor. They served the entire city of Pittsburgh, and then as our population dropped, continued to drop, and we were right around 400,000 at the time we put a referendum to go by district. Well, the reason you go by district is population grows too large. The city becomes so big, it's no longer functional to be able to operate by at large. So you go by district. We went the opposite. Now we have literally districts in council districts of 30-some thousand people. It's ridiculous. And how does that affect the budget? You know all too well. You sit on county council. If the South Side needs a public works project, the councilman from Shadyside said, okay, I'll give that, but I need this. It's a trade-off. They're not all their constituents. Right. They don't do the right thing because they don't serve all the people. And at a time when we need to be a fiscal watchdog, the best thing that could possibly happen is we have a referendum that changes them all back to at-large members. And even then, it's almost the size of a state senate district. State senate districts are almost 300,000. I mean, it's not that big of a district. Yep. And then at that time, you can add that two of them are considered a Democratic member or a Republican member, and they run separately, you know, in just the primary, and you're guaranteed to see it on both of them. I think that would be a good time to bring it up. But I am all for, I think it's been a budget buster. I think it's been an enormous failure of government. And I think we have to, just like you talked about the contributions, this is one of those things where we've realized that referendum didn't serve us well, and the budgets have been blown up because of it. And quite frankly, not that these aren't honorable people too, I have to be careful because I'm not sure I can name five or I'm not sure I can name four city council people. But there is also an argument to be made when you run and have to raise money and run 300 in a district of 300,000 people, the resumes might change too, Sam. You know, and there because your ability to raise money and to bring coalitions together, you know, the level of qualifications would actually, in my mind, rise because you could be a community activist and find a way to win a council seat. I mean, you got mayor's elections this spring that people are telling me only, 45,000 people might vote to elect the mayor of Pittsburgh? I mean, so how many people are elected a councilman?
When Ed Gainey was elected in the primary back in 2021, I believe he received like 27,000 votes.
Yeah, and you see that nationally, you say that's a mistake. Like, if you're looking on the ticker, like, oh, 10% must be in. Like, they could not believe that was the end of the election.
Yes.
So taking another step forward and you divide it by nine, you're winning like school director races for city council. I mean, you could win for a couple thousand votes.
Yes.
You could win a city council seat. So you could be a community activist with no, I mean, the level of qualifications could change.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the time has come to talk about these things.
So that's going
to
be interesting.
Absolutely. Very interesting. And I'm all for it. 100%.
I also want to mention, you know, I think it's important as an elected official that you be truthful with the people that you purport to represent, that you tell the public the truth, okay? And that because they, you know, they need to rely on you as their leader or as their elected official, that you're going to give them accurate information.
Sure.
I'm very disappointed in the county administration in regard to their behavior during this entire budget debate. They came out. First of all, they knew there was a problem. They knew that they had financial issues prior to October.
Sure.
But never said a word to the people in county council.
Who are you talking about specifically?
I'm talking about County Executive Sarah Innamorato.
Okay.
And her team.
Okay.
There had been a meeting scheduled between council and the administration in September to talk about the budget. They canceled the meeting. So it wasn't until October 2nd, 6 days before she gave her presentation to council, they sat us down and told us they had these significant problems and they wanted a 46.5% tax increase.
Wow.
And then, you know, despite knowing and being told that they didn't have the 10 votes to pass that a tax increase of that magnitude, instead of negotiating or looking at how can we come together, they went out into the public and they told the public a number of lies. They claimed than in the parks. You know, permanent closures of all four parks pools, reduction of portable toilets by 70%, complete elimination of the seasonal park rangers, complete elimination of trail maintenance programs, complete elimination of free learn to swim classes, complete eliminations of movies in the parks, summer concert series, holiday events, and acoustic events, closure of Rod Hill Farm, closure of the South Park Buffalo Preserve, complete elimination of the forestry division. Now, they did this in human services. They talked about cutting family support centers. They talked about all kinds of different things. The problem is, Keith, it was all a lie. All a lie. All fear-mongering. Our parks, the total budget in our parks, total budget is $34 million.
Compared to a county budget of what?
Well, the operating budget is almost 1.2. Okay,
billion.
But yes. Billion. But we get that $34 million budget. We get $26 million from the RAD. 75% of the funding comes from the RAD. Another 16% comes from the fees of the people that use the parks, the pools, the golf courses, the ski park, right? There's never going to be a cut. When you talk about human services, in the grants budget, we get $1.249 billion in grants and special accounts. That's money that's not even coming from the operating budget. None of these things were going to take place.
And the press reported it.
Yes, they went out, they made these claims. The press didn't ask second and third level questions.
No, they didn't.
And here we are. But hey, anytime we start talking, we run out of time. You and I.
Yeah, I get it.
You know, we're coming to the end here.
Imagine that.
Folks, I just want to tell you, county administration has not been honest with you, and you need to pay attention, and you need to ask in-depth questions going forward. Now, Keith, thank you so much.
Always
joining
a pleasure
us on the show
to
this
join
week.
You, Sam.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you. Folks,
happy
until
holidays.
Next week. Yes. Well, Keith, yeah.
We're in the season. I'm not going to be back, so I just want to wish everyone a blessed holiday season and a happy new year, and thanks for making me a regular visitor to your Saturday afternoon program, because I always thoroughly enjoy talking to your listeners and to you.
You got it. Until next week, folks, that's it for us on The Elephant in the Room. Have a great weekend.